Let me make sure. Oh, there we go. Yeah, I didn't have the switch on. But you know what's interesting is even though I'm not Jewish, when my wife and I visited Israel, all the Jews there insisted that I had to be a Jew. They said, you got the profile, you got the forehead, you got the nose, you got the bald head, the black hair. No way you're a Gentile. You got to be Jewish. And they were scolding me for not wearing the yarmulke in certain places. And I got scolded because I actually signed a Visa credit card slip on the Jewish Sabbath. Well, no, in Israel, I mean, if you're Jewish, you don't sign on the Sabbath. You put an X and that's it. So, but I actually signed my name and all these Jews jumped up and said, what are you doing? What are you doing? You're signing on the Sabbath.
But it's okay to pull a sheep out of a
well, the other thing, some Jews befriended me and said, you know, the problem is you are here and you don't care two bits about the New Testament archaeological sites. Your whole focus is on the Old Testament archaeological sites. That's one reason why, also additional reason why we're convinced you had to be Jewish. And so it was an easy explanation. The Christian sites are all fake. The Jewish sites are actually real. So I wanted to see the real stuff, not the fake stuff. And I guess the other reason why they thought I might have been Jewish is I was showing up at 6 a.m. at all these sites. And it says, oh, yeah, you know it's free at 6 a.m. So. So we didn't have a lot of money then, and I knew that was the one way we'd get to see the different sites. But I later talked to my dad, and he says, yes, that runs through the whole Ross clan. You know, that special forehead, the nose, the bald head. And he says, yeah, Rosses for centuries have been identified as being Jewish. So interesting time there. So I guess another reason, too, is that, you know, my wife and I visited all the battle sites of the five wars that the Jews had fought with their Arab neighbors. And they were really curious, why is a Gentile Christian so interested in all this? And I says, well, I mean, it's prophesied in Ezekiel and Daniel. I says, you guys know about this? And it's always surprising to me when you run into Orthodox Jews how shocked they are that we Christians know the Old Testament so well and actually follow all these things that refer to the nation of Israel and the Jews as a people. They're also shocked when Gentile Christians have a strong admiration for the Jews as a people. So all that I see is good. So, hey, before I jump into the lesson, I just wanted to announce to you that Jeff Swearink and I had the opportunity of interviewing Gerald Schroeder for our webcast. We let it go 2 whole hours. Normally it's an hour, but we went for 2 hours. He likes to talk, and we didn't want to interrupt too much, so it did take 2 whole hours. But I can tell you this, I learned a whole lot more about what he believes and why he believes in interviewing them than I got from any of his books that I've read. Although I think some of the older booklets are more insightful. And, you know, in reading his books, I thought, well, and by the way, Gerald Schroeder is an Orthodox Jew. He's a physicist, lives in Jerusalem. So we had to interview him at 8 a.m. in the morning our time, so it wouldn't be outrageous on his time, because he was on the phone there in Jerusalem. And it was a very good interview, I mean, a very friendly interview. And he was very good at trying to answer some of our searching questions. And, you know, some of the thing I think that threw me in reading his books is he's obviously appealing to time dilation. And as a physicist, I've always thought it's got to be relativistic time dilation. I mean, it's really the only way you can dilate time. But we found out in the interview he's really appealing to some kind of spatial time dilation. He kind of sees some property in the space fabric of the universe that allows time to dilate. But one thing that we did is we got into the whole question of Psalm 95, where a day of the Lord is like 1,000 years, 1,000 years is like a day, 1,000 years is like a watch in the night. And what that tells us is that God can arbitrarily compress time or expand time. He completely agreed with that. And our response was, well, in that case, why a father to appeal to physics at all? Given that God is transcendent, he indeed can shrink and expand time any way he wants. You really don't need a physical explanation. But he feels compelled to come up with a physical explanation. And he was quite quick to admit, look, I'm not a mathematician, I'm not a cosmologist, he's into nuclear physics, and his presumption was you could get time dilation through the space fabric of the universe, and Jeff and I were trying to figure out, you know, where is he getting this from? So, but in one sense, I don't think it was necessary to pursue it. It's like, hey, that's not even necessary. And, you know, reading his books, I thought he was really into Jewish numerology, and I found out he's really not that committed to it. He is in certain places. Other places, he's very flexible. And so I think that was probably the most valuable part of the interview, is a lot of people think in reading his books that he's got a very specific, tightly nailed down model, and in what we found instead is really quite flexible. For example, in his books, he makes a big deal about how there's the origin of the universe and there's the origin of matter, and how these ancient Jewish theologians put a big focus on the origin of matter, and how the origin of matter is 10 to the minus 11 seconds after the origin of the universe. And so he takes that 10 to the minus 11 seconds, contrasts with the current age of the universe, gets a factor of a trillion difference, then he takes the 13.75 billion year age of the universe, divides by a trillion, and gets the 6 days of creation. Well, not quite. I mean, in his first books, he was looking at an age of 15 and 3/4 billion years, and dividing by 10 to the 12, you get 6.0 days. Now that we know the age is 13.75, you get 5.4 days. So my question says, you know, does that concern you that you're 6/10 of a day off? And he says, hey, if it's within a factor of 10, I'm happy. So in that sense, I'm saying, okay, he's really not the numerologist that you might think he is by reading his books. He's really quite flexible on this. Order of magnitude is good enough. So, and he says, you know, if physicists define the origin of matter at a different date, earlier or later, I'm okay with that. I'm real flexible. And then we got into the events of the six creation days. And, you know, one thing I think he is committed to is the first two of the six creation days are cosmic in nature, and day 3, 4, 5, and 6 are terrestrial in nature. That's probably one of the big differences between our model and his model. We see the 6 days as all focused on planet Earth, whereas he sees the 6 days as covering the whole history of the universe. I said, well, maybe this is a cosmic model. He says, oh, no, it's only cosmic for the first 2 days. Once we get to day 3, it's terrestrial. It's all focused on planet Earth. So he has creation day 3 as the origin of life on planet Earth. So day 3 is like 3.8 billion years ago. And then we question him being astronomers about, you know, what he's written about creation days 1 and 2 and how day 2 begins with the formation of the disk of the Milky Way galaxy. And right away he recognized that that was something very disturbing to astronomers. He said, look, I'm not tied down to that. Give me any phenomena in the history of the Milky Way galaxy and I'm comfortable with that. And that really felt good for us because I thought, gee, he's trying to come up with an event that we know is 11 or 12 billion years ago, yet in his model be like, say, 7 or 8 billion years ago. He says, oh, no, you tell me what happened at 7 or 8 billion years ago in the history of the universe, I'll put that into the model. We couldn't come up with anything right off the bat there other than the fact that maybe that's the time when you have a transition from gravity dominating the dynamics of cosmic expansion to where dark energy dominates that. And I think he'd be comfortable with that, but he was really looking for something that will tie down with the galaxy. So, and I think the biggest difference of all between our two models is the way he defines physical life, soulish life, and spiritual life. And so for him, soulish life would be everything Cambrian explosion forward. It includes insects, it includes fish, it includes amphibians, it would include reptiles. And actually for day 5 and 6, on day 5, he has marine dinosaurs, but no land dinosaurs. And on day 6, he has land dinosaurs as part of his model. So, and then he talked about human beings. And where he is tied into the numerology is that he insists that Adam became a spiritual being 5,771 years ago, you know, taking the Jewish calendar. You count back all the years, kind of like Archbishop Usher does. Archbishop Usher gets 4004 B.C. Jewish theologians living 800, 900 years ago came up with, compared to today's calendar, 5,771 years ago. But he also believes that human beings, as Homo sapiens sapiens, dates back 50, 60,000 years. So he's in complete agreement with our model on the origin of Homo sapiens sapiens, but he says at that time they were not spiritual. They only became spiritual in 5,771 years ago. And also he has a very different concept of what the spirituality of humanity is all about. He sees it as a breakthrough in socialization. And because of that socialization, this is when people begin to live in cities and trade and develop writing. And he's got a point, because writing dates back roughly to that time, 5,771 years ago, and that's when you begin to see people living in large cities. And then, you know, Jeff and I quizzed and said, well, what about when people were living in smaller cities, you know, where you only got, say, 5,000 people instead of 100,000 people? And he says, well, that's before they became spiritual. And so we were trying to say, well, you know, what's the real distinction here between a village of, say, 5,000 people and one of 100,000? But I think he really narrows it down. It's the birth of writing which allowed people to socialize. And so what about all these Homo sapiens sapiens that did not receive the spirit imputation from God? He says, well, by Adam's socialization, the rest of them became spiritual. And so it's through the socialization contact. And so, you know, we would kind of put that socialization as a property of the nephesh, the soulish creatures. And so he has a definition for the soulish creatures that's far broader than ours, but then he has a definition for the spiritual. And so he would say, oh yeah, he believed that people that were not spiritual would actually engage in worship. He says, it's just that they didn't find the true God. And he says, they were seeking God before they were spiritual, but they didn't find the real God until they became spiritual. So, yeah, and this is all completely unexpected in the interview. It's not something you really find in his books, but he says, oh yeah, this is something I'm working on right now. And he recognizes a very different model than ours, but he says, you know, I'm open to changing my model. So we found out, again, it was a very good interview, and it's not yet posted. It will be posted sometime this week. So you,
the nature of God.
Pardon me?
Nature of God. Where is he at?
Nature of God? I think his view of the nature of God is very similar to ours. We did talk about, you know, how certain religions speak of God being transcendent and others as being immanent. You know, like Hinduism really stresses the immanence of God, but it denies the transcendence of God. And how Islam stresses the transcendence of God but denies the immanence. And, you know, he's very straightforward that in Judaism it's both. God is simultaneously transcendent and immanent. So there is definite agreement there. And, you know, he felt that our models were really quite close to one another. You know, we found differences, but we also found large areas of agreement. And so he does believe, for example, that Genesis 1 is historical. That Genesis 1 is God revealing the miracles of creation he performed. He's very much opposed to theistic evolution, which I think is interesting because a lot of people reading his books thought he was the theistic evolutionist, particularly where he starts talking about Adam, and because it sounds a lot like the theistic evolutionary model. But he was quite straightforward with us. No, I'm not a theistic evolutionist, and I believe that God's doing all this through miracles. But there's something miraculous that happens when the spirit comes upon an individual that allows a degree. And what he meant by socialization is he says, you know, before 5,771 years ago, there weren't large cities, there weren't writing, because people weren't getting along with one another. And once it became spiritual, then they got the capacity to get along with one another. And this is where peace came, although I think there's some examples where you might dispute that. You know, I do see him as a learner. He's really trying to, you know, put this all together. And he also appreciates very much the the benefit of his interaction with the Christian community. He speaks a lot before Christians. He says, you know, as I teach them, I'm learning too. So we really did appreciate the spirit he brought to the interview. But you can listen to it to yourself. We're posting it with no editorial changes whatsoever. You get to hear the whole thing. So. Well, you know, there may be something to that. I could tell he was really trying very hard to please us. And so, you know, he may be, I don't know. I have to listen to what he says in other interviews. That's one reason we kept him on the line for 2 whole hours, so that we could really find out where he stands. And, you know, we let him know, look, we're comfortable with the differences. We don't have an issue with that. And, you know, that's not our goal here. Our goal here is not to debate you or to challenge you, but just to find out what you believe and why you believe it. Well, I mean, listen to the interview and see for yourself. But one thing I think Jeff and I did come convinced from is that if he is a theistic evolutionist, it's not the same stripe as, say, biologos. I mean, he was very emphatic. No, I believe God creates the life forms. It's not something that happens through the evolutionary process.
All right, but then so, what
about Steve here? He's not here today. Yeah, he is. Yeah, Steve's here.
For various reasons. But as Dr. Ross, I think, and you probably know, theistic evolution covers a wide, broad aspect, too. And the main question for me, and I think all of us need to get to, is when does special intervention come? When does God intervene? And Dr. Ross has presented it at the species level. Others who I don't agree with in theistic evolution would say that God wound it up in the beginning and let it go. I believe in intervention, but I think the theistic part or God part of evolution shows actually a grand design in evolution that speaks the glory of God, or I would not be there.
Yeah, and I think one reason why he gets labeled a theistic evolution, at least from the part of the interview we heard, is that he doesn't believe that God created Adam as a single individual with Eve from whom we're all descended. Rather, God created these Homo sapiens sapiens who are non-spiritual beings. He did say that God created them, and they lived for, you know, 40, 50, 60,000 years, and then God selected one of them and made that person the real Adam, the spiritual Adam. But through that spiritual Adam, God performed a miracle through the social interaction of that Adam. All the other Homo sapiens sapiens became Adams. So that's kind of his model, as I understand it. And, you know, he was not saying that this is just a natural process where God picks out an Adam. Because that's quite common in theistic evolution, where there's all these hominins running around, and then God picks one and makes that one the Adam, and then somehow all these other ones die off. And I thought that's what he was talking about. And I said, well, do you mean that all the other hominids of which Adam was a part just simply went extinct and all that's left are the descendants of Adam? He says, no, I believe that Adam, through his spiritual socialization capability, was able to pass on the stamp of spirituality to the All Elders, so it wasn't necessary for all of them to go extinct. And so I believe that that was a miraculous intervention. So,
then he discounts the statement Eve is the mother of all living.
Well, here's where I think he's coming from. He really wants to be faithful to the scientific record. But he also looks at these creation days in Genesis 1 as undeniably 24-hour periods. So we've got the six 24-hour days. He doesn't see any gaps in the genealogies, which is where he comes up with that 5,771 years. And so we have this very recent date from the Bible for Adam, and yet we've got the scientific evidence for human beings being around for 50, 60, 70,000 years. So he's trying to keep all that together. You know, in other words, he's trying to integrate that. And I'll tell you, the real textual difference between our two positions is that he insists that these creation days in Genesis 1 must be six consecutive 24 hours because he says if God meant ages, he would have used the Hebrew noun olam. But what I noticed in his books and also what I heard him on in his interview, he's using the word olam the way it's defined in modern Hebrew dictionaries, not the way it's defined in the Old Testament. Although I did find one of his books where he defined olam the way it's defined in Biblical Hebrew. And here's a distinction. In Biblical Hebrew, the word olam means a long time ago, or it means time indefinite. It's never used to refer to a definite long period of time. However, in modern Hebrew, the word can be used to refer to an era or an epoch. So in different books, I find them using one definition or the other. But from our perspective, God can't use the word olam to describe a long period of time, because in Biblical Hebrew, it's never used for a definite period of time. It's only used for indefinite time. And therefore, the only option you've got is to use the word yom, that's translated day. And by the way, Schroeder does agree that yom can be used for a long period of time. But he's persuaded by the fact that you've got an evening and a morning for the 6 days, that they have to be 24 hours. We did not have time to get into the discussion, how come there's no evening and morning? And we did. Yeah, that is part of the interview. We did talk about evening and morning not being present for the seventh day. But he is convinced the seventh day was only 24 hours. And we didn't really have time to discuss, well, how come God's still at rest today if the day is over? We didn't want to interrupt too much. So we kind of let him talk, and he went off on a few tangents. And eventually in the second hour, we did interrupt him just to kind of keep back on topic. He's quite open to say, look, I'm flexible on this stuff. But I think that's the main reason why he insists that they have to be 24 hours. And therefore, he's looking at some way to reconcile the billions of years with the thousands of years, and also to reconcile the 50, 60,000 years of proven human existence with the 5,771 he gets in the Jewish calendar. And also, to be fair to him, what he's saying throughout the interview is this: I'm not presenting my beliefs so much as I'm defending Maimonides and Maimonides. Now, these are, Jewish theologians that lived in the 12th and 13th century. And he says, I like them because they were writing before all these scientific discoveries. And what we can document is that they were accurate in reading the Bible, reading the Talmud, and coming up with a correct description of the world of nature as we know it today. And frankly, I think that's one of the more most positive contributions Schroeder has made in his work, is to document that Big Bang cosmology was discerned by Jewish theologians in their study of the Bible 800, 900, even 1,000 years ago. And therefore, we can't say they're simply reading Big Bang cosmology into the Bible because they already know that's the correct interpretation for the universe. I mean, people have made that charge against me. Well, Hugh, you're a 21st century astronomer. Of course you're going to read Big Bang cosmology in the Bible because you already know that that's the correct interpretation of the universe. But that criticism won't work with Maimonides or Nemonides. They lived hundreds of years before any scientist had a clue about Big Bang cosmology. But what I think Schroeder is doing is trying to push that into other areas of science as well. So, yeah, John. I'm trying to remember. We did talk about that. I'm trying to remember what came out of that. Because, you know, where Jeff and I were pursuing, okay, is Adam something that God took from the dust of the... I think that's his position. That rather than God simply choosing one of these hominids to be Adam, he makes him from the dust of the ground, and through that Adam imputes the spirit nature to all the other surviving hominids that are around. He was insistent on referring to these human-like creatures as hominids, not human beings. We kept calling them human beings. He kept interrupting us, saying, no, these are hominids. They're not human beings because they're not yet spiritual. But he did agree that they were 100% identical to us in terms of our physical characteristics, that they were 100% identical to us in terms of their intellect, their ability to do mathematics. So even their capacity to search out and worship of a god. So it's a very non-traditional view of what spirituality is all about. Yes?
In the rest of the hominids contracting a spiritual nature from Adam.
Oh no, he was insistent that only extended to Homo sapiens sapiens, not to the Neanderthals,
right.
Not to Homo erectus, just to Homo sapiens sapiens.
The spirit that he put into Adam, this somehow infected the other like hominids or Homo sapiens. Then, what is the spiritual nature to him? How could a Joe over here, a regular, non-spiritual Homo sapiens sapiens, contract a spiritual nature? Quote-unquote, from Adam. How could that be contagious, if you will? I mean, how does he define
it? Yeah, we asked him that question. And he says a contagion is through social contact. In other words, the only way you could pick up on this spirit nature from the Adam that God created from the dust of the ground is to come into social contact with this person. So it took a conversation. Well, I mean, say what you will. What we try to do is say, look, you know, we have our own idea of what spirituality is all about. And other Jews and Christians have their perspectives on this. We just want to find out where you're coming from. And so we just kind of ask some questions to define what it is. So, yeah, it's very different. But, you know, I thought it was helpful for our audience, our constituents, to find out exactly what does he mean by the spirituality
so
of human beings.
So spirituality that we have today is not a creation from God upon conception.
No, he wasn't willing to go that far. And he didn't want to say where he stood on that issue. You know, we let him be ambiguous where he wanted to be ambiguous. And we do that with all the leaders across the creation evolution spectrum that we interview. Is that we're not trying to make them uncomfortable. And if they don't want to answer the question, we don't make them answer the question. So we just try to find out where he was comfortable answering the questions. So, yes.
Maybe you already just answered it, but he's basically saying spirituality was taught, like you're teaching us. And if that happened over a year, you know, how many does he say there were at that time that it was taught? Then how long does it take to get from one end, the first person?
Well, you can listen to the interview, but the thing that we got away from it was that the real important distinction, the spirituality of human beings, is our capacity for social communication. In other words, before the spiritual Adam, social communication was limited. Now, it wasn't non-existent. He did say they were living in villages. He did say they were trading. He did say that they had spoken communication with one another. But their level of sociality wasn't at a point where there could be peace throughout a whole nation, where people could build really large cities and organize those cities and have written language. So, but, you know, we thought he'd be defining it in terms of worship, and he says, no, they were doing that before. The difference, however, he says, is the worship that people, these Homo sapiens, were engaging in, was not making contact with the real God. In other words, all the worship going on before was basically a blind search to find the real God. Now, he did say that he felt that many of them were on an honest search. It wasn't that they were all worshiping Satan, that they were, many of them were honestly seeking God, but they couldn't find God until God had imputed the Spirit on this Adam that he made 5,771 years ago. So that's kind of his theology. So, you know what? I don't want to go much further in this. I want to get into the lesson. I'm going to be gone for a couple of weeks, but I will. I mean, this side here did have. You know, I'll take two, and then we'll go on. Go ahead.
Okay. I think that I don't know. Well, this is a good example of how hard it is for people to get the same interpretation of the Bible. If a Jewish scholar, you know, and you are at odds with something. That just shows how hard it is. But the origin of spiritual, to me, began when we got consciousness. And as soon as we got consciousness, we could see the things that, you know, lightning, volcanoes, and all that. We had great fear and awe. And that kind of is a kind of a spiritual thing. You know, you get and I'm sure they had God. They have to have totems. They have to have a sacred cave or a stream or a tree. Even the old Jews had that. Ancient Jews, they don't have that. So to say that, you know, God gave that spiritual life when at some point in time, because of all these hominids running around with their same brain like we have, and they didn't have gods before Adam. I don't believe that.
Well, I'm not defending that, Al. In fact, I would say most Orthodox Jews and most Reformed Jews would be highly disturbed at the theology of Gerald Schroeder. You know, they would take a view of spirituality that's very close to how Christians view spirituality. It's actually taught in Psalm 139. This is the text we've been looking at. And if you go through Psalm 139, King David is bringing up repeatedly aspects of the unique spirituality of the human species. And you raise a good point. Look at the brain that Homo sapiens has. It is the only brain amongst all species of life that's even got the hardware to engage in spiritual activity. So why would there all be all these Homo sapiens running around with the brain hardware to engage in spiritual activity and it not being manifested? Well, let me read this from Psalm 139. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth, and your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. Now, that's just a little bit. You can read the entire psalm. But what King David is pointing out is because of the spirituality, the unique spirituality of human species, we actually ask these kinds of questions. You know, we say, I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. We're the only species that looks out at the natural realm and says, where did this come from? Who's responsible for all this? And why did this God create all this for me? Why did this God create me? Non-spiritual beings don't engage in those kinds of questions. We see zero evidence of the Neanderthals engaging in those kinds of things. And so I think you can integrate the Bible's teaching on spirituality with what we observe in the real world. You know, just say, what is the difference between human beings in terms of our psychological makeup and all other animals in the face of the earth? I've got a book coming out in September that really talks about the latest scientific experiments being done at UCLA and UC San Diego that are looking at the psychology of the human mind and contrasting with the psychology of the most advanced animals that they've ever done experiments on. And, you know, I wrote about it in my book on Job because it says, you know, 4,000 years ago, this was obvious to all human beings. Today, it takes brilliant scientists to discover these facts of the differences. Kind of reminds me of this famous research study that was published at the tune of $7 million of U.S. taxpayers' money, documenting that human women and human men are physically different from one another. It's like, you know, do we really need to spend $7 million to figure that out? So, let me at least get started on this. In terms of what we've been doing here is looking at the three origins of life. And by the way, that was a lot of our discussion with Gerald Schroeder. He did agree with us that Genesis 1 is talking about three separate origins of life. You know, a lot of Christians don't agree with me on that, but Gerald Schroeder agrees that Genesis 1 addresses the creation of physical life, the creation of soulish life, and the creation of spiritual life. His definitions are different than ours, but he does agree that that indeed is something that the Bible teaches. He also agrees that that's a profound challenge to any evolutionary model, of these three different origins of life. Well, we're on the third one now, the origin of spiritual life. And this is kind of the evolutionary paradigm for where we got our spirituality, that it gradually evolved from these primates into the human species, although some would argue that we evolved from an even more primitive knuckle-walking species. So, yeah, we're starting to come into that season again, so. Oh, my older boy has been watching hockey, and he says, I think we're actually seeing more primitive behavior amongst the hockey players than we are football players. But what I want to begin with is something called the causality laws. And, you know, this is something we're taught as freshman physics students. I remember the first week of taking physics at the University of British Columbia. They introduced us to the causality laws and say, if you understand these laws, you won't go wrong in your future career in physics. And the first of these laws is that effects cannot be greater than their causes. Now, let me put a Christian interpretation upon that. The created could not be greater than the creator. Okay, so if you're looking at a causal agent, what that causal agent produces has always got to be lesser than that causal agent. So in terms of where we human beings came from, you have a problem from a non-theistic perspective. Namely, that we human beings are personal, we're soulish, and we're spiritual. But the non-theistic evolutionary models tell us that we evolve from material that's not personal, that's not soulish, and it's not spiritual. So how can the purity physical give rise, the purity physical, the purity impersonal, give rise to something greater than itself, namely something that's personal, soulish, and spiritual? Now, I'm saying this as an introduction into the scientific case that you need divine miraculous intervention to explain the human species. Now, this is something simply based on the causality laws that were taught in freshman physics. But if you want the correct answer in physics, you always need to appreciate that the effects cannot be greater than the causes. And by the way, that really held as a valuable lesson for me when I became a sophomore, a junior, and a senior in terms of trying to solve these physics problems and do these laboratory experiments our professors kept torturing us with, is just to always go back to these causality laws, and it's a great guide to the correct answer to whatever problem or experiment or observation that you're performing. Yes?
And that causality law, what's the basis of that?
It goes all the way back to Greek philosophy and to Jewish theology. So it has its roots thousands of years ago. Well, it's a faith that we live in a world that's consistent without internal contradictions. So this would be in contradiction to say what you would get from Hinduism and Buddhism. You know, in Hinduism, there's a willingness to tolerate internal contradictions in their study of the natural realm. That's one reason why we don't see the scientific revolution coming out of Hinduism. It doesn't comport with physical reality. And so what you've got in Christianity and Judaism is people in Greek philosophy say, look at the natural realm and say, guess what? Everything seems to be consistent. Everything fits together in a harmonious fashion. There must be some reason why that harmony and that consistency exists. Right? And then Greeks began to develop mathematics. And in mathematics, these causality principles are at the heart of trying to build a consistent mathematical system. So, as many scientists I knew at Caltech said about these causality laws, we believe them because they work. They won't say, I believe them because this is something that's taught in the Bible and this is consistent with Christian theology. They just say, we believe it because it works. But it works because of these underlying principles. And because it works, therefore people are convinced it must be true. But these same causality laws directly challenge this idea that we human beings arose from, as you heard on Star Trek, the slime in this little pond. I think that's been shown dozens of times on TV. They always seem to pick that one episode, you know, where Captain Kirk is looking at this little slimy pond and says, that's where we all came from 4 billion years ago.
That was Jean-Luc Picard.
Oh, Jean-Luc? Okay, I could be. I've never actually watched the episode, but my colleagues tell me they've seen it many, many times. But it does directly contradict these fundamental causality laws. And there's another aspect here, too. Life is living. We have a hard time defining what life is. But the whole point here is, can that which is living come from that which is non-living? So there again, you've got a problem with the causality laws. We got living creatures from an evolutionary perspective coming from that which has no life at all. And clearly that which is alive is greater than that which is not alive. So contradictions all the way through. And I say this because this is something a five-year-old, I think, can comprehend and use in their discussions with their teachers and others. You don't need all this fancy physics you see in the background to try to make this argument. Anybody can make this argument. And it's something that has been fundamental to Greek science and to Western science, literally, for thousands of years. Now, what I want to do is actually directly examine the evolutionary models, of which there are many, but what they all have in common is that you have the first life on planet Earth, which is bacterial nature, and by the way, these are rather advanced bacterial cells that we're seeing here. But the origin of life, we have these unicellular life forms, and then through some evolutionary process, we wind up with these advanced creatures. Bacteria to man. Now, there's an interesting conference. Oh, by the way, I'm out of time. A couple of weeks I'll pick this up. But where I'm going to get to are a group of physicists and a group of evolutionary biologists that actually examine this problem. You begin with bacteria. We all agree that's the first life on planet Earth. We end up with human beings or their equivalent. What would have to happen from an evolutionary perspective to go from here to here? What are you going to need? How much time are you going to need? And is it even mathematically possible? And so we're going to look at two different calculations of this, one from three theoretical physicists and the other from an evolutionary biologist. And I think what makes this interesting, they did not look at this problem in terms of challenging Darwinian evolution. In fact, all of these people who are doing these calculations believe in Darwinian evolution. Rather, their goal was to look at this problem to see if we should be spending tax dollars on the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life. That was their real motivation. And what they failed to realize is that that result had an application to the problem of here on Earth. Can you go start with bacteria and wind up with human beings without God's direct miraculous intervention? They didn't examine that problem, but what I'm going to suggest to you is that it has an application to that problem. But I do agree with them. Based on what they've developed, we shouldn't be spending a dime on the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life. And by the way, as an astronomer, I think there's a very easy way to prove to the taxpayers and to Congress, don't give these people a dime of our money. Why? Because they can't yet find a single star where there's a possibility of a planet orbiting that star that could have intelligent life upon it. And you know what I would say to my friend, by the way, I've got personal friends who are involved in the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life, some that I went to graduate school with. But you know, my response to them is, until you've got a star, why bother to waste the telescope time? Because stars are easy to measure, they're easy to find, and we've yet to find a twin of our sun anywhere in our Milky Way galaxy. And you're going to need a twin before you even got a chance of finding this intelligent life. And I say that because it bothers me as an astronomer how many thousands of hours of valuable telescope time has been wasted on the search for non-existent extraterrestrial intelligent signals. Well, it's been defunded, but they're still getting money from the likes of Paul Allen, and I'd like to see Paul Allen's money put to better use. And by the way, I think it's great that we got the Allen Array. It's an amazing instrument. I want to see it dedicated to the study of quasars, galaxies, pulsars, the search for planets outside of our solar system, not for trying to tune in to these intelligent signals. And I say it's a provable waste of time because they're looking at stars where we already know ahead of time that that star cannot have a planet going about it with the capacity to support life. So, till you've got a star, don't bother to spend any money. Okay, with that I want to close and then I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Father in heaven, Lord, I ask your hand of blessing upon Fuzz and myself as we go back to North Carolina to teach a seminary class on science apologetics. And Father, I pray that you would help us to teach that class in such a way that it could be used to train people all over the country. So Lord, give us the grace, the humility, and the wisdom to do a quality job and to really minister to the students that we'll be presenting. And Father, I pray too for whoever will be teaching this class in my absence, Lord, that you would anoint him with grace, humility, and wisdom. And that, Lord, you'd make this class a blessing unto you. And, Lord, make all of us a blessing unto one another. So go with us, Father, and give us opportunities to share the reasons that we have for the hope within us with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience. In Jesus' name, amen.